You're listening to Policy Currents, a weekly podcast from RAND. I'm Deanna Lee.
And I'm Emily Ashenfelter. Every Friday, we bring you new insights from RAND's latest research and commentary. It's June 21st.
Russia views its partnership with China as imperative for maintaining the claim that Russia is a great power, while China sees the relationship as an effective counterweight to U.S. power. Given these perceived mutual benefits and the two countries' recent coordination, what are the prospects for future Russia-China military cooperation? A new RAND report finds that, as Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine illustrates, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping appear to be committed to sustaining their mutual support, even in difficult situations. However, both leaders have limits on military cooperation. For instance, the likely costs of direct military confrontation with the United States make it unlikely that either country would be willing to enter a combined military operation. And although the possibility of a combined operation remains uncertain at best, other forms of strategic and military cooperation between Russia and China could intensify. This might mean more complex and more frequent training and exercises between Russian and Chinese forces, interactions that may lead to expanded transfers of technology and skills. Similarly, increased integration could potentially lead both militaries to consider operating in new geographic areas or domains, perhaps with new operational concepts they develop jointly. What can the U.S. do to counter this growing partnership? The authors of the study conclude that U.S. efforts to break apart the China-Russia relationship are unlikely to succeed. In fact, such efforts may only motivate Xi and Putin, and potentially their successors, to strengthen the partnership. That means that the most effective way for Washington to counter China-Russia cooperation is by ensuring the health of its own alliances and pursuing ever greater cooperation among America's most important allies and partners.
With the Supreme Court's decision in 2022 to overturn Roe v. Wade, abortion access is now determined state by state, and states have the authority to ban abortion at any point in pregnancy. But how exactly have state and local policies changed because of this ruling? And how have these changes shifted the situation for providers? A new RAND report offers insights into these questions by examining the effects of abortion laws and policies in one state, North Carolina. In May 2023, North Carolina passed Senate Bill 20, which limits abortion to 12 weeks and 6 days, with exceptions for cases of rape, incest, or medical emergency. Prior to the law taking effect, abortions were broadly legal in North Carolina during the first 20 weeks of a woman's pregnancy. This new law also added an in-person counseling requirement to the already required 72-hour waiting period for both procedural and medication abortions, modified required consent language and signature requirements, mandated detailed reporting requirements for abortions performed after the 12th week of pregnancy, and established penalties for physicians and healthcare providers who violate the regulations. It's worth noting that some parts of the legislation are in flux as courts consider challenges to the rules. To learn more about the impacts of this legislation, our researchers reviewed existing laws and documentation about abortion care in North Carolina and interviewed clinicians who regularly provide abortion care and non-clinicians who work at facilities that provide abortion care or organizations that support abortion access. The findings reveal that abortion care providers in North Carolina are spending more time on administrative tasks, are frustrated with new required consent forms, have feelings of anxiety and burnout, and fear for the future pipeline of abortion care providers. Further, some abortion facilities reported having to reorganize or change clinical workflows, adjust staffing, adjust to higher costs, and in some cases, physically relocate their clinics to adapt to the state's new abortion rules. Interview participants also reported that the new law created the need for many new compliance functions that did not benefit patients, such as protocols for documenting medical emergencies. They also emphasized the disproportionate impact Senate Bill 20 had on people who already were marginalized, including low-income people, immigrants, people of color, adolescents, and patients living in rural areas. Notably, most people interviewed for the study felt that the new law did not impact a patient's decision to have an abortion, just when and where they received the care. This case study of North Carolina can offer lessons for other jurisdictions as they evaluate new abortion care policies and consider their impacts.
Only 1/3 of outpatient community mental health facilities offer medication treatment for opioid use disorder. That's according to a new RAND study that surveyed 450 clinics in 20 states with the highest opioid-related overdose deaths. The clinics that did not offer medication treatment said they referred patients to other clinics for such care. In fact, many clinics reported sending patients to sites within the same treatment system. Notably, factors that increase the likelihood that clinics would provide medication for opioid use disorders included being a certified behavioral health clinic, providing integrated mental and substance use disorder treatment, offering housing services, and having on-site laboratory services. Understanding access to opioid medication treatment is important. More than 80,000 Americans died from opioid overdoses in 2021. And the standard of care for treating people with opioid use disorder includes medications such as buprenorphine, methadone, and naltrexone to aid recovery. This treatment approach is associated with reductions in healthcare use as well as decreased overdose mortality. But despite its effectiveness, medication remains underused. In fact, evidence suggests that nearly 90% of people with opioid use disorder did not receive such care. The findings from our study are also significant because an estimated 25% of adults with opioid use disorder have a co-occurring mental illness. This suggests that increasing the number of community mental health clinics that offer medication for opioid use disorder may be one way to improve uptake of medication-assisted treatment.
With more working hours and lower average base pay, teachers report worse well-being than other working adults. RAND research shows that this has been a consistent pattern since 2021. According to the latest RAND State of the American Teacher Survey, an annual study of K-12 public school teachers across the United States, teachers report working an average of 53 hours per week. That's compared with 44 hours for similar working adults. And 15 hours that teachers work per week, roughly 1/4 of their overall working hours, were outside of their contracts. Teachers reported earning roughly $18,000 less per year on average than other working adults. And just 36% said they considered their base pay adequate, compared with 51% of their counterparts. The responses also reveal teachers' top sources of stress in 2024: managing student behavior, low salary, and administrative work outside of teaching. Further, Black teachers report working significantly more hours per week on average than their peers, while female teachers report significantly higher rates of frequent job-related stress and burnout than male teachers. This raises questions about the sustainability of the profession for Black and female educators in particular. This is the fourth consecutive year RAND has collected data that raise concerns about high stress and low pay in the teacher workforce. Our insights may help federal, state, and local education leaders and policymakers better understand the challenges facing America's teachers.
Some in the United States worry that North Korea could carry out an October surprise by conducting a nuclear weapons test. We can't know for sure whether North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would take such action, but he has several reasons for doing so, says RAND's Bruce Bennett. To start, Kim has likely been waiting to have a more powerful nuclear weapon design before attempting one of the weapon tests he might be able to pull off without severe consequences. It's possible that Kim has that design now, especially if either the Russian government or rogue Russian scientists have helped in such a development. Additionally, Kim may see October as the perfect time for a weapon test. It would garner a large amount of outside media attention around U.S. election time, allowing him to grab the spotlight from, and in his view, potentially embarrass President Biden, who Kim likely feels has largely ignored him. What's more, Kim could use that outside media attention to bolster his claim to senior elites in North Korea that he is recognized in the world as an important leader. Kim may also be eager to potentially affect the results of the election. Kim knows that Biden is unwilling to compromise with North Korea, but Kim may hope that former President Donald Trump would be willing to bargain if he won a second term, just as Trump did in the 2018 Singapore summit. Kim may in fact have even higher hopes, Bennett says, that his dream of North Korea being recognized as a nuclear weapon state could be realized.
That's it for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, check out the show notes at rand.org/podcast. We'll see you next week. RAND is a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis.